kids was playing multiple sports.
Sure.
But ultimately, I think that golf just, you know, for whatever reason, it really just captured my passion, and I slowly, you know, stopped playing the other sports and concentrated on golf. And that was a tough thing to do, where I grew up out in West Texas and went to Permian, which was the high school featured in Friday Night Lights.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Football was a big thing. Football was a big part of our lives. And, you know, I grew up in that environment and played it up through ninth grade. But, you know, at the end of ninth grade, I really knew that golf was what I wanted to do. So, you know, I kind of kid my friends there that as well-known as Permian was for state championships and football and all that, the 3 years I was there, the only team to go to state twice and win one state championship was the golf team.
So you proved to make your decision. You know, it proved that it was the right decision. That's for sure.
Yeah, it was a good decision. You know, we had a lot of good players on the team, and interestingly enough, most of them were football players, at least up into high school. One of them was the quarterback of the high school team, was on the golf team that won the state championship. So, you know, and it's kind of something I found in that I think kids are generally attracted to golf. I think golf is appealing to kids. I don't know what it is, but I think that kids are attracted to the sport. But, you know, all the other sports just kind of take over that space. And now the way that sports are going, where they're playing year round, they're playing in all these camps, all these travel teams. I mean, it's just a big money operation.
Yep.
And so all these kids just kind of get siphoned off into the other sports. So it's very difficult for golf to capture them. But, you know, as we all see, ultimately, once they go through that period of time, and come out on the other end and get into their careers, if they were golfers when they were little, they go back to playing golf. Or, you know, I've seen my boys, their friends, who are a lot of more baseball players, are big golfers now.
Sure.
You know, that's what they really like.
No, you're right. There's a cultural or societal aspect, you know, to, I mean, your town is like the poster child for it. I mean, that was a football town. So there's a sort of, it acts like a giant vacuum that just sort of takes over, you know, all these athletes, and people feel as much obligated to play as much as they want to play. And like you said, then now with the specialization of sports, there's a sort of this not only an economic pressure, but also just a sort of a keeping up with the Joneses pressures for athletes to play in all these travel teams and whatnot. Because if you don't sign up soon enough, or you sign up too late, or whatever the case may be, you're going to be left behind, because you got kids who've been in these travel teams since they were in second and third grade, which to me seems to be really a little absurd, to be honest.
It's totally different than the way we grew up. And I think there's also kind of that pressure where I think some parents maybe are feeling that pressure where, if their kid does not, or if their kid does well in a sport, then there's a scholarship and there's a way to go to college.
Right.
It doesn't, bankrupt the family. And I don't know how big a part that plays in it, but it certainly does.
I agree.
I think that if you can get your child into a college and get most of it or some of it paid for because of a sport, I think there's that added pressure as well, but golf is a good avenue for that as well. I mean, I'm not sure how much money is available in scholarships in golf, but there certainly are a lot of golf programs around the country, and I know that I've heard that the women's golf programs in the colleges are desperately seeking more players coming into the program, and you know, I've heard that there's more money available for that avenue as well.
Well, just to give you, and my numbers might be a little off, but there's some, just to give you a little perspective on that in terms of money, there are, I think, around 3% of high school athletes go on to play Division I sports, and less than 2%, maybe 1.5% of those athletes are Division I scholarship athletes. So parents... I feel like you're better off not thinking that way. And if you get one, then, hey, that's, you know, icing on the cake, as opposed to letting that drive your decision-making for children. But anyway, that's a whole nother can of worms that we could get into. Well, let's. So what was it? I'm just curious, what was it about golf? I mean, that had to have been a significant pull. If anybody knows Permian, which I think most of us do, like you said, that's a very football-oriented town, and that must have been, like I said, a huge magnet for the town and for kids to want to be associated with that program. So I would have to say that there must have been a significant pull for you towards golf to pull away from that. What was it about golf that appealed to you so much?
It's hard to know what exactly it was, but I just remember, how comfortable it felt to be out on the golf course. I'm kind of one of those people that enjoy playing golf by themselves. So, we would have our match. Maybe we'd go out and play in the morning. And we played all the time. I mean, that was also something that was really fun about growing up out there. There wasn't a whole lot to do. There's just not a whole lot to do out in West Texas. So, we spent a lot of time at the golf course. And I think it's just being outdoors. When you're a kid, when I grew up, it was Nicklaus and Watson. And so you're out. Sometimes out in the evening playing golf by yourself, but you're playing in the U.S. Open, and you've got that one shot lead, and you're coming into the final hole. So there was just that kind of thinking about the game and that inspiration. I mean, Nicklaus was an inspiration, and his career was an inspiration for you as a kid. It really, really appealed to me even out in West Texas. But I think it's just the environment. And then, when you have some success and we were having some success in junior golf, we certainly had some success in the high school golf program. I think that just makes it even more exciting. But there's just something about the game that I think the neat thing about the game is, unlike other sports, is it's all on you. I mean, you don't have, in a team sport, a football or whatever, you can blow a coverage, you can make a mistake, and there's people around you that can make up for your mistake, or it's not something that's going to possibly ruin the competition that you're in. Mm-hmm. But when you're an individual playing golf, it's all on you. Every single shot's on you, and maybe that was it. I mean, I think just the idea of being out there in total control of your competition or of your round, and everything depending on you, I think was appealing as well.
I think you're talking to a man of a similar heart. I love playing by myself. Played yesterday by myself. It's just. And like you said, there's no hiding. It just it exposes you if you're not playing well. Like yesterday, I didn't drive the ball well, and you can get exposed if you play a golf course that demands that of you. And talking about Laurel Links actually, but we'll get to that whole that story in a second. But it is. It's on you, and there's nowhere to hide. So you had this love of golf and how did that transform into golf course architecture?
I don't think it transformed initially in golf course architecture when I went off school. I went to the University of Texas in the architecture department.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be a designer, but I did have the notion that I would be able to design the clubhouses and design the golf courses. At some point, that entered my head that you could design golf courses. And therefore, I had it in my head that I would do the whole thing. I would be the architect of everything. And then as I got into the third year of the program at UT, I realized that, that was overreaching, and mm-hmm. that my desire to be more involved in golf, that I missed it. It was just a part of my life every day up through high school, up through the end of high school. And when I got in college, as I got further away from those high school years, I you know, missed that involvement in golf day in and day out. So I decided that I really was not going to be able to do everything, and that I needed to just focus on whatever degree I needed to get to kind of help me get into golf course design.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized that there was, you know, something called landscape architecture, which was not the best college program that could train you for golf, but it's, you know, it's not really that specific toward golf.
Right.
But it gives you some skills that allow you to get into golf course design. And so UT did not have a landscape architecture program, so I transferred out of there and went to Texas A&M. Had a really good landscape architecture program. And I think they punished me severely for that because of the competition between the two schools, and made me retake a bunch of classes.
That rivalry runs deep.
I had to spend 3 more years at A&M to get my landscape architecture degree. And then 10 days after that, after I graduated, I started at Robert Von Hagee, who was based in Houston and was there for 11 years. And one of the courses that Bob designed is... I forget what they call it, but it's the national club and national golf course in France, which is where they're having the Ryder Cup next month.
Oh, French national. Yeah.
Yeah. I forget what they call it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
kind of how I got into it. I guess it, there was that thought that you could do something like that, that came into my mind probably more as I got toward the college, you know, into the college years, first year or two, and just went ahead and just made that move, wanted to make that move. But I think that I missed that involvement with golf day in and day out.
Right.
And when you grow up with it like that. And,
sure.
And it's the same thing now. I mean, there's periods of time where you go without playing, but playing golf has always been the most appealing thing to me. There's some people who kind of get into the business and they stop playing because the business aspect of it takes over. And, you know, everybody complains about not having the time and all that. But to me, and not having the time to play 18 or whatever, but to me, if I'm going to play golf, I'm going to make the time for it. And
sure.
If it takes 4 hours or 5 hours or 6 hours, with travel and all that, I don't care. I mean, I can't imagine, doing anything else that is more enjoyable. So
yeah.
I'll make the time for it. I'll play 18 holes. There's a big move now toward people trying to play 9 holes or wanting to play 9 holes because they don't have time. And that's, it seems to be a reality. It seems to be the way golf is going right now. But I'll take 18 holes any day.
Absolutely. Well, I want to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to talk about Laurel Links Country Club. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Golf course superintendents are the unsung heroes of our great game. Due to the game's efforts, we now have turf that needs less water, courses that are more sustainable, with many now offering natural wildlife habitats. From the days of old Tom Morris, golf course superintendents have given golfers a reason to love this great game. But don't take my word for it. Jack Nicholas agrees.
If you love golf like I do, thank a golf course superintendent.
A message from the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America and local superintendents everywhere.
Owning the latest and greatest golf equipment makes no difference if it's not fit perfectly for your game. At Mizuno, we create irons and woods for all skill level golfers, from our MP18 family featuring 3 different models designed for the better player to our JPX family featuring 3 different models designed to give you distance and forgiveness. We have a model for everybody. Visit Pete's Golf Shop and get custom fit for a set of Mizunos today.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony, and on the line is golf course architect Kelly Blake Moran, who designed Laurel Links Country Club on Long Island. Kelly, tell me a little bit about how you came to Long Island and your thoughts on the, for someone who describes their philosophy as land-based, but yet it was pretty flat out there when you probably arrived. So tell me a little bit about Laurel Links.
Initially, I came out to Long Island when I was looking at a project called Calverton Links. They already had 9 holes there, and I found out that they wanted to do not actually 18 more.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove out there, probably got out there about 9 o'clock in the morning, met with Bill Shulman, William Shulman, who was the owner of Calverton Links, and sat in his office for about 12 hours. Didn't leave till that night.
Wow.
Just talking with him about golf and business. And it was just one of the most delightful people I've ever met. It was just such a wonderful man and just had such great insight in the business and golf. And so, I ultimately worked with him and another gentleman out there is a really, really great shaper that lives out there, Kevin Nolan. And we built 9 holes for Mr. Shulman. And then, and the superintendent there, Bill Nohel, is a great guy. So I really was lucky that I met such wonderful people out there when I initially went out, and just really attracted me to that area. And then David Saland, who was behind Laurel Links, I guess learned about me from my involvement at Calvert and Links and invited me over to meet with them and see if I might be the right kind of person to help them design their golf course. And he had a layout done by an engineer, and they had, this engineer had laid it out, and I think he was a golfer. And there was an environmentally sensitive area. I don't know if you remember that wooded area between hole 3 and hole 8. There's a wetland that goes through there. It's forested, and it was on the, people in the North Fork Environmental Council knew about that particular area. And in the initial layout that the engineer did, he had golf holes crossing over that area. And he was emphasizing to David how beautiful that area was and that it needed to be exposed to golf and what a challenge it would be and all that. And I believe that I'm not sure if that plan was presented, but somehow that plan had been viewed by the council, and so they were very much opposed to the project. And David, when he got me involved, he said, Kelly, is there a way to route this golf course and avoid that area? And to me, it became clear that we had plenty of land to avoid it and work around it, and that's kind of how why the routing is the way it is, in part was to avoid that area between holes 3 and 8. And once we did that, then and had more discussions with the environmental council, I don't think they approved the project, but they didn't oppose it, or they didn't come out against the project. They didn't have jurisdiction to disapprove it, but they didn't come out against the project.
Right, right.
So they, they changed their view of it. We got through all through the permitting process, I think, because of that, because that they didn't oppose the project. And I believe one of the first groups that was allowed to have an outing out at Laurel was North Environmental Council, North Fork Environmental Council.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, that was a neat thing, the way it worked out. And, I think that the golf course has been a great neighbor and has been a great environmental asset to that area. And, you hear talk about how golf courses may not necessarily be the best environmental land use. And it's just so far from the truth, because
yep.
as you see these golf courses, as they get older, I mean, there's a course I did down in Naples, Florida, called Hideout. And I was there earlier in the summer, and, we're on the 12th fairway watching a family of bald eagles fly around the golf course.
Right.
And then we see, many other diverse species of birds and mammals around the golf course, and the same's true at Laurel.
When I was playing yesterday, there was a hawk. And that was carrying, that was flying, and I think it was carrying a frog. It was probably delivering, that was probably takeout for the family at home.
Right.
One of the things you would never have guessed if someone didn't tell you is how flat the land was when you got there. But you didn't add anything, you just moved a lot of stuff. I mean, that must have been a tremendous effort. And, talk a little bit about how that is the difficulty in that, and sort of when you're land-based and you have natural features to work with, then that's one thing. But when you're flat, relatively flat, I should say, you've moved quite a lot of dirt around there. Talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, the approach was, the approach that I took there, what was it, 19 years ago, was to not rearrange the land, kind of like we did at Von Hagee, where we just moved dirt and and put mounds down both sides of the fairways and kind of frame the holes. But instead, Yes, it was very flat. There was not a lot of pitch across the entire property, so you do have to create pitch in order to have drainage.
Mm-hmm.
But my approach was to take the low areas that naturally existed on the property and if needed, make them lower, and take the high areas that naturally existed on the property, and that's, relatively speaking, because, like you said, there wasn't a lot of movement, but there were high areas, there were low areas on the property, and make the high areas higher.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the low areas, made them lower, took the high areas and made them higher to try and create more elevation change.
Right, right.
So that was a good way to still kind of tie in with the natural landform and not disturb the natural landform, so that those high areas remained high and those low areas remained low. We just exaggerated.
Right, right.
That when we and then we did dig ponds. We did dig a pond on 17. I believe the thinking was that that was going to be the irrigation pond, because typically what I'm used to is we drill a well, we dig a pond, we feed the pond and irrigate from the pond. But ultimately what we did end up doing was putting in multiple wells and pumping directly from those wells into the irrigation system. So the pond at 17 ended up just becoming a water feature and not an irrigation pond.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of dirt that came from that excavation, which mostly went between 17 and 8, hole 17 and 18.
Right.
But that was generally the approach. We did have a company in there moving the dirt, but really there was just two guys, Schaefer, that I'd worked with since my Von Hagee days, a guy named Kenny Edwards and his son were basically the two people who built the golf course, along with the golf course superintendent, Bill Shuford.
I was going to ask you about that. How important was that working with Bill on the development of the project?
I think it was very important, and I think it continues to be very important to this day. I mean, the wonderful thing about Laurel Links is it's the stability of the people who have been involved in it from day one. Bill's been there from day one. Steve Haggerty, the pro's been there from the beginning when they opened up. And just recently they had a change in general manager, but the original general manager, Joe Paff, was involved from the very beginning. So, Laurel Links has always been a very stable, it's produced a stable environment for this club to grow, which has been great because of the key personnel who have remained with it.
Sure.
But having Bill there from the very beginning was instrumental in the success of it. And he just has, that whole property and the way it's developed is just infused in him. He understands what we were trying to achieve from the beginning, and he's taken it even further. I mean, it was a good golf course when we were done, but it's become a much better golf course because of Bill and the way that he has grown it in and maintained it and helped it evolve and make it better. So, that's just can't ask for more to have somebody who has been there from the beginning and to help nurture it along. Bill's done that.
Sure. Like any other enterprise, continuity is really important. We're running short on time here. Only have about a minute, but I was struck by not only the movement of the land that you created, but also the bunkering I thought was just tremendous. Was that something that you just sort of, that sort of the land that what you were moving around just sort of presented to you? Because to me, the bunkering is really strong there.
I think that the bunkering, you like to think about the bunkering in terms of strategy and where it's placed and how that's going to, create strategy and how people play it, either taking the bunkers on directly and trying to carry them or play around them or position themselves in an angle where they don't have to carry the bunker into the green.
Right.
So strategically, you're thinking about that. I think at that time, 18, 19 years ago, I was also concerned about visual and the beauty of them and how they're presented and seen, which I'm less concerned about that today. But back then, I think that I was concerned about that as well. And that's a little bit of the Von Hagee that was still in my system
Sure.
as I came out of that. So
yeah. Well, Kelly, I want to invite you. Maybe we could do a podcast or do a part two of this, if you don't mind, because there's a lot to unpack there at Laurel Ranks.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, we don't have enough time to do it here. But I want to just thank you, first of all, for joining me this morning. Pleasure to talk to you. And two, I want to talk to you about maybe the next time you're out, we can go against our instincts to want to play by ourselves, and maybe we can join Bill and play around, maybe have a match together out on the golf course.
Yeah, I would love to do that. That'd be great, Anthony. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for joining this morning, and we'll talk soon about the part two podcast. How about that?
Very good.
All right.
Great.
All right. Thank you. You too. That was Kelly Blake Moran, golf course architect, Laurel Links Country Club. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Have a great week, folks.
The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.